What did you hope to achieve by adopting a Conservative idea, One Nation? Was it trying to cosy up to voters in southern England that you lost at the last election?
I think it was trying to say who I am and what I believe, and I thought a lot about this. I gave a speech 8 months ago at a One Nation banking system, which is how can we have a banking system that really serves the country, not the banks and the rest of British business. And when, the more I thought about it, the more I thought actually One Nation, which as you say was originally a Conservative idea, expresses quite a clear view about where I want to take the country, a country where there's three things in. It's one, where everybody has a stake. We don't leave young people out. We don't leave 1 million young people out of work. Secondly, prosperity is fairly shared. You don't have runaway rewards at the top which aren't earned. And thirdly, we protect, and this is a small C Conservative idea, we protect the institutions we value, whether it's the United Kingdom or the National Health Service. So I'm certainly not a One Nation Conservative, but I think that it's about a One Nation approach and a One Nation Labour Party.
Now, the thing with slogans that people come out with at party conferences, they often last the length of a party conference and then they're forgotten
about
again.
Not this one.
How are you going to take this forward and how are you going to convince people that it relates to them? Because some of our listeners are saying that One Nation is as confusing as a message as Big Society. Do you think there's a risk that people don't understand the complexity of it?
I think what's obviously the case is that we've got a job to do over the next 2.5 years to explain what it means in each area, from, you know, health to education, right across the board. We've done some of that this week. You know, in education, we're saying, yes, 50% of young people going to university matters, but 50% of young people who don't go to university, they matter too. They matter too because we care about them, but also we're never going to succeed as a country unless we get them the qualifications they need. And if I said to you, take a 14-year-old, you know that if they're academic, they're going to do A-levels. But Ian, if I asked you, what qualifications are they going to do at 18 if they're not academic? I don't think you'd know. I don't think
no,
I would know.
But I agree. So, but wasn't that the problem when you first came out with this 50% target? That was always going to be the result, and you should have addressed that when you were in government.
Well, I don't actually see it that way. I think that the 50% target wasn't particularly wrong. It's just we should have worried more about the other 50%. And I'm open about the fact that we didn't do enough on that. And that's what I'm changing. And, you know, we've had this conversation before. I'm not somebody who says everything the last Labour government did was right. One Nation Labour is a moving on from New Labour. It's certainly not a return to old Labour, but it is a moving on. It is accepting that we didn't get it right on responsibility at the top, on the power of some of the vested interests like the banks. And also there were too many people who didn't feel that we were speaking for them.
How do you break out of Westminster with this? Because it's all very well the Westminster media understanding it, and I think that the reaction from the Westminster media has been very positive to your speech. How do you get it out there in the wider world? Because all they really ever see of you is sort of sound bites from Prime Minister's questions, the odd speech here and there. How do you connect with them? Are you going to do what
really
Paddy Ashdown did when he first became leader and sort of go on a country tour for 3 months trying to sort of evangelise about One Nation?
Really good question. That is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go around the country. I'm going to Corby this afternoon to talk to voters there about the One Nation Labour message and about how we can build One Nation together. And I'll be going right around the country with this message. You know, I've always believed that the most important thing for a leader of the opposition is to have clarity about a message, clarity about how they want to change the country, and then the policies to start filling it out. I think we've done that this week, and I think that's why this week is important for us. I know we've got a long, long way to go, but as you say, I mean, we have got two nations, politics and the rest of the country, and I'm determined that we become one nation in that sense too, and that's why I'm going to take the message around Britain.
Now, the message of One Nation, in a sense, is about bringing the country together. It's about healing, isn't it? So why do you and your colleagues keep creating division by slagging off bankers and millionaires?
I don't really see it that way, Ian. I want to bring the country together. But I think it's a government that is cutting taxes for those earning over £1 million a year while raising taxes on everybody else that is driving our country further apart. I want to bring Britain together. But Britain together means you need responsibility all the way to the top, and you need a sense of shared sacrifice. Dare I say it, we're all in this together.
And I wouldn't say that if I were you.
I think I should, because I think the government had it right on we're all in this together. But unfortunately, they haven't followed it through. They've done the opposite of we're all in this together. I think they had the right idea. And if I may say this to you in particular, particular. I think what you see with this government is that conflict between an old tradition of one nation conservatism and what you might call a more free market individualistic conservatism. And I think David Cameron used to say he was for the first. I think he's ended up going for the second, and I don't think that's what the country needs.
Do you know the difference between income and wealth?
Yes.
Because I ask that because you and your colleagues seem to be under the illusion that every millionaire is going to get a £40,000 tax rebate as a result of the cut in the top rate of taxes. It's not true, is it?
Well, the point I'm making is this, which is that there are, I think, 8,000 people earning over £1 million a year. Now, there'll be some people who believe it's right to be giving each of them a tax cut of at least £40,000 a year. Now, if there are people who think that's correct, I'm afraid I disagree with that. I think when the country is in such difficulty, when there are people who are listening to this programme whose living standards are being squeezed, people who are in poverty, I don't think that's the right approach for the country. And you know, that's just a difference of view that we have, or that I have with some people and this current government.
No, and I can understand that. But the message that you sent out in your speech and others have said this week is that all millionaires are getting this £40,000 tax cut. And a lot of people have even been saying, well, David Cameron's going to get it. Not true, is it?
Well, as I understand it, David Cameron is going to be getting the tax cut. It
goes to not £40,000.
It goes to those earning over £150,000 a year. But a particularly bad part of it is that those earning over £1 million a year, £40,000 tax cut. Now, look, if some people think that's the priority for the country, that's absolutely a legitimate point of view. I just don't think it's a priority for the country. And that is a difference. That is about one nation. How do you build a country that has a sense of shared sacrifice? You see, I'm not denying difficult economic times now and difficult economic times for the next Labour government, but my reading of history is the only way countries get through this is with a sense of shared sacrifice, shared endeavour, and a sense that there's fairness and fairness in the decisions that are made.
Somebody phoned into our programme last night saying that you want to have it both ways. You're going to go on a march organised by the TUC against the cuts, and yet in the next breath, in your speech, you said you're going to have to keep most of the cuts. You can't march against cuts and then on the other hand say you're going to keep them. Which is it?
I don't agree with that. I think that what I'm doing on the October the 20th is talking to concerned people right across the country who are saying, look, we are seeing really terrible impact in our communities and we don't think it's fair. And I will be very open. I am very open, and I was last time I spoke at a TUC rally, that if we were in government there would be some cuts. And that's very, very clear. But and I said that in my speech yesterday, today before yesterday, but I beg your pardon. But the reality is that I think that what this government doesn't seem to understand is that right across the country there are people who are not denying reality that these are tough times, but who don't feel it's fair. And I have a duty to speak up for them and speak with them, and that's why I'm very happy to be speaking at that rally on the 20th.
Let's look at the next 12 months. You're in a very different place now to that you were in 12 months ago. No one's talking about replacing the leader of the Labour Party anymore. The media view of you seems to have changed quite substantially.
They're talking about replacing the leader of the Tory Party,
indeed, the Lib Dems. So that's interesting. But looking to the next 12 months, what is your main challenge? Because I would think you've got to get some policy out there now. By this time next year, your conference speech is going to have to mainly be about what you would do in government.
You see, that's the interesting thing about the way I delivered that speech on Tuesday is that lots of people then focused on the way I delivered the speech. I never quite thought I'd be accused of not being talking about substance enough. You know, actually in my speech I was talking about policy on banking, on energy, on vocational training, on a whole range of policy areas. But your challenge is right. Over the next year, 18 months, we'll be setting out how clearly One Nation speaks to right across the board in all areas of policy. And I think by this conference next year, and then the following year, certainly 2014, people will have a sense of a manifesto. We're not yet in a position of having a manifesto, but as over time that will become clearer. But I think we have set out quite a lot of substantive policy this week.
You spent quite a lot of time in your speech talking about your values and the people that you learnt things from. You didn't mention Gordon Brown. What's the most important thing you learnt from Gordon Brown?
I think the most important, the two lessons I would say, one positive, one not so positive. The first lesson is a sense of somebody sort of passionate about the country, passionate about his values, passionate about how he wanted to change the country. But as I said yesterday on the television, also, I think after 10 years in government, I think that we should have had in 2007 more of a forward agenda for how we wanted to change the country. I think that's what I've set out myself this week.
Why have you waited 2 years to deliver a speech like that? Because those of us who have seen you do a speech like that before have never understood why you haven't done it on a big platform before now.
It's a good question, really. I'll be frank with you. You've seen me do a speech like that before, have you?
I wasn't actually there, but I think wasn't it in the 2008 National Policy Forum you did one, had an effect on people.
Here's what happened. I came off the platform last year, and thought, actually, I could have delivered the speech without notes because I'd written the speech myself. And in a way, if it's what you believe, you don't need to be reading it out from a piece of paper. Mm. You can actually be saying it. So, goodness knows, you learn in this job. I'm not promising to deliver every speech I ever do without notes. I think that would be a rash politician's promise. But I enjoyed it. And the main thing is, if you're enjoying it as a person, as somebody delivering the speech, I suppose what I've learned is there's a higher chance of the audience enjoying it.
And you can do a lot of impromptu jokes, which you can't when you've got a set text.
Totally right.
And they worked. Now, just finally, because I'm sure that you've got other things to do this morning, just tell us a bit about your teacher, Chris Dunn. I talked to him on Tuesday night, and he was telling me a story that he used to phone into LBC a lot, and you, as 15-year-old, you said, well, how does that work? And then 2 weeks later, he tunes into LBC, and here's you on Clive Bull.
So this is my this is true. I did this stint when I was a teenager on a program called Young London, which you probably won't remember.
Well, no, I do. It existed up until a couple of years ago.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Doing reviews of films and music, I think. It was my sort of early experience in the public eye, but it was fun, and it just came about because I rang a phone in once, I think, and that's how I got involved. But Chris Dunn was a fantastic English teacher, and I had it wasn't an easy school, my school, but I had really, really inspiring teachers in English, in maths, in physics. I mean, I did reasonably well in my A-level physics.
I got ungraded O-level at physics.
My goodness, I did slightly better than that. But, and actually it was not because I had any talent for physics, but it's because I really had a great teaching. And in a way, I think it's quite an important corrective to the sort of stereotype that people can have about inner London comprehensives. I had the most brilliant teaching, actually, at my school, even though it was not the easiest, school to navigate your way around.
No, really, this is finally. You said that you're a fan of Dallas as well. How can we be sure that as Prime Minister you would be a J.R. Ewing, not a Cliff Barnes?
Oh, my goodness. Look, I'm not sure J.R. Ewing is a great character to aspire to, actually. I thought you were going to ask me what Cliff Barnes' favourite food was. Do you know the answer to that question?
Well, actually, I'm a huge fan of Dallas. I've got all the box sets, but I can't... Chinese, wasn't it?
Chinese takeaway, yeah. You're right. I thought you were going to try and test me on my Dallas knowledge.
No. We're both as sad as each other. Are you watching the new series?
I have not watched the new series.
Maybe brilliant.
Maybe that's what I'll be doing during the Tory conference
week. Get
Justine. I'll be watching the box set, the new series of Dallas.
Well, get Justine to set the Sky Plus. It's absolutely fantastic.
Okay.
Edmund Levan, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Ian. Cheers.